over to you.
So thank you, Honourable Chair. As usual, the Parliamentary Committee on Health always stretches us and makes us work very hard and stretches our minds to think a lot. The burden of disease unit that we have here.
Can we, members, starting to give to respond on issues that we've raised?
So, as we mentioned before, the MRC has 11 research units, and they're all positioned to strategically advance research to improve the health of South Africans. So the burden of diseases is the canary. You know the canary in the mine? In the olden days, they used to put a canary in the mine, and the canary could smell that there was no oxygen and would start chirping. And the burden of diseases are our canaries for the country. They're the people that look at the statistics, look at the deaths in our country, and alert us, the mine workers, to either get out of the mine or to do something new. And so the data that we get from the canaries are very important because it helps us to understand our burden of disease and how we need to do it. And so the first thing I'm going to answer, I'm going to do the first stab at the questions, and then my team will do the rest. And I'm going to address the issue first of infant and maternal mortality. With the page that we sent around, we can see that since 2000, we haven't impacted on neonatal mortality, and that is the deaths of children in the first 28 days of life. You can also see that our under-5 mortality is stagnating from about 2011, and our infant mortality rate is slightly to stagnate, and those are important figures. So why haven't we managed to change mortality in the first 28 days of life since 2000? And that's because children are dying either from stillbirth, prematurity, or infection in the first 28 days of life. So stillbirth accounts for a third of all deaths in the first 28 days of life. So how do we stop stillbirth? We stop stillbirth by making sure we can identify high-risk pregnancies and triage those high-risk pregnancies before they become a stillbirth. And how are we doing that? So we have developed something called the AmbiFlow, which I've brought around, which looks at uterine blood flow. And this uterine blood flow, if administered to the woman, if we put the Doppler machine on the woman in the last few weeks of pregnancy, we can pick up reduced uterine blood flow. We can triage these women to the hospitals, and we can avert a stillbirth. And we've rolled this out in Mamelodi, and we've shown by implementing this simple device, we can reduce stillbirth. We've showed it to the Department of Health and to WHO, and we're now embarking on a wide-scale implementation of this Doppler device in South Africa, in the rest of Africa, and in India, to show that maybe this is the one way we can reduce the third of the mortality in the first 28 days of life. So again, South African innovation with using Doppler can hopefully reduce death rates due to birth asphyxia. The next other cause of neonatal death is prematurity. So how do we stop prematurity? What is the biggest cause of prematurity? It's infections like groupie strep. And so how do we stop groupie strep? We're investigating developing a groupie strep vaccination. And the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation is working with the BioVac to develop a groupie strep vaccination so we can give to pregnant women to stop groupie strep infection, which leads to prematurity. And then we can start dealing with other reasons of prematurity. The other causes of death in the first 28 days of life is neonatal infections, of which things are like, again, groupie strep. So if we can manage, if we can prevent birth asphyxia, prevent prematurity, and prevent infections in the first 28 days of life, we can probably improve our infant mortality rate. Why is our under-5 mortality rate not declining? Why is it stagnated? And that, again, is due to infectious diseases. So it's around TB, diarrheal diseases, which we need to carry on working on. So we need to make sure that we're rolling out our rotavirus vaccination to prevent diarrhea. We need to make sure that our preventable communicable diseases can work. And so this is why this data is good, because it says to us So we can tell the Department of Health, our under five mortality rate is stagnating. We need to do something about it. Infant mortality, neonatal mortality rate is stagnating, and these are the reasons why, and this is what we need to do about it. So this helps us design studies and interventions with the Department of Health and with other scientists in South Africa to try and work on this. In terms of maternal deaths, you see the figures from 2011 to 2014 on the paper that we gave you. Why do women die during pregnancy? They die from the three H's: hypertension, hemorrhage, and HIV. And so we have to work on making sure that women who are HIV infected during pregnancy are diagnosed and get onto treatment, and we can manage that. How do we deal with preeclampsia? And so we are doing research in preeclampsia, hypertension, to try and find ways of diagnosing hypertension in pregnancy so we can manage it better. And then hemorrhage as well. You know, how do we stop women hemorrhaging and dying? And we're working on developing sublingual oxytocin to stop hemorrhage. Women get a syntocinon in their arm, which is a drip, which means you have to be in a hospital or in a clinic and you have to have a nurse who's able to deliver that. But imagine if we had a drug that you put under our tongue. Women could have it anywhere in the world, not only in South Africa. And that would be a game changer. And so we're working with PATH to develop a sublingual oxytocin that will prevent maternal hemorrhage. And so we take all this information that we receive from our canaries, and we try and direct research that will impact on the lives of South Africans, not only in drug discovery, but making sure that we develop interventions that we can use in the field, like this Doppler machine that I spoke about. So that is the one thing I'm going to say about infant mortality. We're working with scientists and the Department of Health to make sure that we erode it away and make sure that we contribute to reducing the rates of deaths. And if you have a look, I don't think we showed you that figure, but if you look at the maternal deaths are coming down, and they're coming down because we're treating HIV properly. And we still need to continue to treat the other things properly, like hemorrhage and hypertension. And we're not doing that very well in South Africa, and we need to work on that. I'm going to talk a little bit about the issue around interventions for exercise. And it's a complex thing, exercise in children. I myself have a child who's a 13-year-old boy. He comes home from school, he sits in front of the TV, he eats rubbish, and he's getting fat. And I'm saying, now, why is this child not exercising? You know, and then we look and see, why doesn't the child exercise? And because whether we're in the suburbs or in the townships, parents are scared for their children, and they tell their children to stay inside, don't go out into the yard, someone's going to steal you, you know, something's going to happen to you, you know, if you're in the Cape Flats, someone's going to shoot you. And so stay in the house because we're caring parents. And what happens is our poor children sit in front of the TV and play games and they eat rubbish. And how do we get our children to exercise? That's a hard thing. In the UK, they've made a kind of a rule that children have to exercise a certain amount of hours at school to circumvent the kind of stuff that happens at home. The MRC did a study in schools to try and get children to exercise. But what we didn't understand is how poverty impacts on exercise. So these kids only had one school uniform, and their mother said, "Don't you dirty that uniform." And so when the teachers wanted to do the exercise, the kids didn't want to exercise because they were terrified. If they dirty their school uniform, their one school uniform, what's going to happen tomorrow? And so if we don't make sure that kids have school uniforms, you know, that they can, their shower facilities, when these kids would come in from the classroom, they would be stinking, and then the teacher would open up the window and, you know, spray stuff around and embarrass the children. And so we have to take into account that if you are going to have exercise programs at school, we need to look at, you know, what about their school uniforms and what about their ability to clean or shower at school so that they don't get humiliated in the class. And so exercise has not worked in South Africa because we have not addressed the issues of poverty and the issues of making sure that kids aren't humiliated because they may have body odor after exercising. And then we also haven't addressed the issue of security because we keep our kids in our homes because we care about them and we don't want them to be shot in the Cape Flats or shot or have abducted. So we keep them in their homes, and that is not good. And we also have television and games, in which we also have to address. So it's a complex thing, the issue around exercise in children. And every child, you know, whether they're middle class or poor or upper class, they all suffer from this issue of sedentary lifestyle. And we need to address that very importantly. But what we do know from our burden of disease, which is very important, is that South Africa has made huge, you know, we should be proud that our interpersonal violence has gone down. And it's gone down because we have political stability and we also have gun control. And so we should celebrate that we can see the direct, you know, like tobacco, gun control, political stability and tobacco legislation translates directly into lives saved. And that's an important message that we can show you today, and that we should learn from that. Going to the issue around foods and frozen chickens, it's true. Chickens have lots of things in, like growth factors, growth promoters, and things that could affect health outcomes, which we do need to investigate. And so we do have a group at the MRC called SA Foods, and they work closely to try and understand the composition of foods and how that impacts health. And so that's an important thing that we need to bring up to you. In terms of deaths by HIV, Debbie will talk a little bit about it, and we'll talk about the issue you asked about. We only had data up to 2012, and she'll talk to you about how we, you know, some of the issues around that. But I think the question also was, how do we prevent HIV? And the way we prevent HIV is to understand the epidemic. Okay, so the epidemic is easy and difficult to understand. Young girls are at risk of getting HIV, and they get HIV from older men, transgenerational sex. These young girls get HIV and they grow up and they become 25, and they have same age relationships with men. And these men get HIV from these women, and these men have sex with young girls, and the cycle continues. And so how do we break the cycle? We break the cycle by finding interventions for young girls to protect themselves, like a microbicide or an HIV vaccine. We protect men from getting HIV from women by making sure women are on treatment, and so they're not infectious. And so that's why test and treat is very important. How do we protect men from getting HIV from the women that they're sleeping with who are same age as them? It's male circumcision, condom use, and other interventions like PrEP and vaccines when we have them. And so it's just to try and break that cycle of HIV infection. And if we break that cycle, we're always going to be in this cycle of HIV, and we're never going to be able to prevent HIV. They have estimated that if we are able to diagnose 90% of everyone in the country that has HIV infection and immediately put them onto treatment, and if these people who are on treatment take their medication and become aviremic, we could probably start to control HIV by 2020 and put an end to AIDS by 2030. But we're all far off. Not one country in the whole world, not Switzerland, not Sweden, not the US, not Botswana, and not South Africa, have managed to ever get there. And so that is what we need to work to, but it's very hard to find 90% of people in the country who are HIV infected. The biggest bottleneck to doing this is to find ways of getting people to know their HIV status. Because once you know your HIV status, you can then move on to the next thing. And so that's what we need to do to try and prevent HIV. And HIV testing is the bottleneck. We're very happy that the WHO have eventually approved the HIV self-test. So now we have a self-test. People can test themselves for HIV and hopefully access care on that. And we've been working together to develop the guidelines on self-testing for the country. So we're very excited about that. In terms of on the issue around TB and why we can't control TB, we have the gene expert, and you know, why not? Why can't we manage to diagnose TB? And if I had my way, I would make TB a medical emergency. That every time the gene expert said TB positive, a bell would ring, and the nurse or the doctor would be hysterical that there was someone who had TB and would rush out into the community and bring the patient, the contact, into the clinic and start TB treatment. If we did that, if we cared that there was a TB diagnosis. So we don't see TB as a medical emergency in this country. And until we see TB as a medical emergency, we're never going to control TB. Yes, our drugs are old. Our drugs are more than 50 years old. They're toxic, and they're horrible to take, but they cure TB. And if we can get people onto TB treatment, we can even with the terrible drugs that we have, we can cure TB, and we're not doing that. And we're not doing that because we're not bringing the we're not matching the diagnosis in the lab to the person in the community and bringing them in for treatment. We only have the BCG vaccine, you know, so we have the oldest vaccine in the world. You know, why don't we have a new TB vaccine? You know, because no one is interested, because only poor people get TB. And so we are working with people to try and find a TB vaccine. You know, the GSK, Sanofi, Pasteur, all of them, they do the market and they say there's no market. We don't make money and profit out of TB, so why bother making a TB vaccine? So that is one of the problems, is that big pharma are not interested in TB vaccines. There was one study that was done just recently. It was a failure. It looked at a new TB vaccine using MVA. It failed, and so all the drug companies pulled out of making TB. Sanofi Pasteur is developing a TB vaccine but won't spend its own money. It uses American taxpayers' money, NIH, to run the trials because they don't want to waste their money on the TB vaccine. So even pharma are not interested in TB. When they make TB drugs, they cost a fortune. A third of our TB budget on drugs goes to drug-resistant TB, which is about 0.3% of the TB burden. A third of our budget is spent on 0.3% of people with TB because of multi-drug resistant TB, because of the cost of those drugs. So we have to ask our question, why are these drugs so expensive? Why do we have to pay so much for drugs? Who is making money out of TB? And those are the kind of philosophical questions we have to ask about the way drugs are sold in the developing world. You asked the question about where do we go, how do we translate all our evidence into practice, how do we get people to stand up and listen. So we have a unit called the Cochrane Unit that tries to understand how you translate evidence into policy, into scale-up. And there's a big gap that we can show the evidence and we can make the policy guidelines, but no one picks them up. And this is worrying the Departments of Health. How come we have all this information and at the clinic, nurses and doctors aren't scaling up those interventions? So we're trying to understand the theoretical framework into which how to translate evidence into practice. And that's the science in itself. You know, we all know we mustn't drink and drive, but we drink and drive. That we must buckle up and we don't buckle up. And that we must exercise and we don't exercise. So how do we take evidence and translate it into action? And that is one of the things that we're trying to understand about humans. And if we don't understand how to translate evidence into practice, we're never going to change our healthcare in any way whatsoever. And so translation is very important to us. Debbie's going to talk about the global burden of disease and the national burden of disease and talk about the issue around death certificates and the gunshots. I like the idea of the tuck shops, you know, and I do think that with our SA Foods people, we should go and do an investigation of the tuck shops and see exactly what has been sold and at what level, you know, at what quantity has been sold. All those cheap foods like knickknacks that are illegally imported into the country and are sold in packets, you know, what are they doing to our children? How much salt have they got in and what do we do about that? We spoke about the impact of unemployment, what that does to health and also to stress levels. And I agree that the issue of poverty and unemployment is a huge determinant of health and has terrible health consequences that we need to articulate better, particularly to key opinion leaders so that they can understand what it is to be unemployed and what it does to your health. In terms of the question was made about the carcinogens, so we have a lot of carcinogens in food that could cause cancer, and we need to address those kind of things. We need to have more information about what goes into our food and how that affects our disease. You spoke about the blood type, and The blood type diet is compelling because it takes into account when certain blood types arose at certain times of human development. And O was at a time when people were hunters and ate lots of meat. And A arose at the time when we were farmers and ate more grain. And that's how our blood group originated. I'm A, and I used to love drinking red wine. And when I read that A, red wine is good for you, I could no longer drink it because I liked to drink it because I thought it was bad for me. So I stopped drinking red wine when I thought it was good for me as a blood type A negative. But that's just, I think, in terms of diet, I think we all have to look at ourselves and find a diet that suits our lifestyle, our culture, our body type and our blood type, and find a way that works for us and our family. So I do agree with you that diet is very important, and we need to understand how diet affects our health. And so we pay little attention to our diet, and we need to do it. We do have a non-communicable disease unit at the MRC, and I would like to propose that we bring this non-communicable disease unit to the Parliamentary Committee to talk about diabetes and to talk about some of the things that they're seeing in South Africa in terms of non-communicable diseases, to unpack it further, the information that we've given you. The issue of obesity is a complex thing. We are looking at, we're doing a 5-country study. We're looking at an intervention delivered at the time of pregnancy in China, India, South Africa, Canada, and Brazil, to try and understand an intervention, and if you apply it to a community in those different countries, what are the epigenetic issues associated with childhood obesity. So we are looking at some of the epigenetic components of obesity across these countries to try and understand, what is happening, and can we explain it, and are there any interventions that can help these children. And then I should end also to talk about the mental health will be covered by other people. Non-communicable diseases can be prevented in a large part by controlling sugar, tobacco, alcohol, looking at activities and diet. But there's also an epigenetic component to non-communicable diseases that it's critical for us to understand. Because if we're trying to get to the bottom, when we start to stagnate in these areas, it's because we've done everything that we can in our power in terms of altering things like sugar, tobacco, alcohol, but we haven't understood the genetic or the epigenetic component of that disease, and that's also why it's critical to continue to look at that. And then in terms of the provincial differences are very important, and we do engage at the provincial level to explain to people at MINMEC and at other areas to show how the disease is different, and that we can try and help the provinces to look at their disease and try and change it in some way or the other. So I'm going to stop there, and the others are going to pick up where I haven't covered or have missed out. Debbie.
It's a very wide range set of questions, and some of it's covered and some of it's not. Can I start with the definition? The GBD is the global burden of disease, and the NBD is the national burden of disease. So it's got very similar methodology to take data sets that are available, assess where it's deficient, and develop methods to account for those deficiencies, so make adjustments. And the GBD global burden has been done for all the countries separately. So there's a GBD estimate for South Africa that comes from Washington. Mental health, of course, is an important part of the burden of disease, but it doesn't show up when you look at just the deaths. We're in the process of trying to go beyond the measure of years of life lost and look at DALYs, disability adjusted life years, where we add the non-fatal component. So anxiety and depression will start to feature when we look at the broader measure of burden of disease. The importance of the HIV drop, we were asked how much the drop has been, because we've got figures 300,000 deaths in 2005 and 150,000. From the peak, the death rate has dropped by 49% in those last few years. The figures that are available for HIV, I think at one point UNAIDS was the main agency that was helping countries estimate the impact of HIV in countries. And I think that we've seen, certainly from the year 2000, that their models have been adjusted downwards. So they were probably overestimating the impact of the disease right at the beginning, but they have been brought downwards. And I would urge members in the House to take note of the South African model, Tembisa, that has been developed by researchers at UCT, a very complex model that accounts for interventions, treatments that are available, and is the Department of Health is making use of it to try and keep track of the HIV epidemic. I'd like to assure the honourable members that we work very closely with StatsSA. We've worked with them for many years, and we're in the process of trying to set up a study, a validation study, where we will take a sample across the country of people who've died and interview families and obtain medical records to compare with the death notification form that has been completed by the doctors. And it's not StatsSA's fault that the statistics they report on are not as robust as we would like them. It's what the doctors are writing on the form. And we're also in discussions with the Department of Health about training of doctors. It's not done routinely in medical schools. It's only in certain medical schools. We would like to see it done when doctors are trained as students and when they do their community service to do some hands-on practice on certifying causes of death. It's not easy to make those decisions and complete the form. So there's an area of training of doctors that we believe is important. The other issues that I should take on, the expanding burden of disease, I would love that, but I think there are other priorities too. So we need to improve our systems and make them better so that we don't have to do as much work with analyzing the data. We are certainly, as Professor Gray mentioned, we are trying to disseminate the information and have had some presentations to some of the provinces and we've written something for the South African Medical Journal to bring it to attention of the clinicians in the country. And we've got our information on the website, and we certainly could try and move it to a level where it could be perhaps more useful to people in the street. So the translation work, there is more to be done. I'm trying to think if there are particular things. Yeah, so aside from the work that we're doing with StatsSA on validation of the information, we're also working with Home Affairs and Health to try and get the death notification form changed. the issue about gunshot, it's when a death is possibly due to external or unnatural causes, the deceased's body is taken to forensic services run by the Department of Health, where there has to be an investigation. And the information that they obtain cannot be put on the form. There's no proper space for it. So we're wanting Home Affairs to agree to change the form and bring it in line with what the WHO recommends around the external manner. I think that's progressing well, and we hope that will happen soon. Prof. Gray mentioned that we have seen declines in tobacco-related mortality and the injuries, and the other one that I think is important to look out for is the salt regulation that has been implemented, and we're hoping that that will have some impact on hypertension and therefore the cardiovascular condition.
Just to add on the regulations, because there has been evidence base showing that the regulations are cost effective, and the only thing that's needed is enforcement. So if there are regulations in place, like now for tobacco control, we see there are some regulations, but the enforcement could be a problem. So that can cause these conditions to lag. And also now with the sugar taxing and the salt, we think that's the right direction.
Okay, I do think that all our concerns and comments and questions have been addressed. But I think in more listening to you is that we have to try and ensure that we don't work in silos, because when we talk that came as you're responding to the issue of chicken now. Where do you bring in the Department of Agriculture in this whole process of, and the unit that you are working with? And I think that is going to be very important, because at the end, we must, if, because whether you like it or not, when you talk about radical economic transformation, you are to bring in all the factors that are going to enable you to do that, and health is about them. You can't talk about economic transformation and outside health, outside education, outside safety and security. And I do think that this process is a process that is then going to enable us, because people that are to work, they are to be healthy. It's just unfortunate. I'm looking here, as I was sitting here, I'm looking into people that have, that will come and listen. And I've observed something that very few members of the public come and listen, except on a matter that has got controversy. If there was controversy, you'll see this room will be full of people that will be. But health is about an issue that we all take it for granted. And institutions of your nature, therefore, are then going to be very important to always ring that bell, that at the end of the day, if you don't take care of your health, you won't, I'm just making something very, if I don't take care of my health, I won't finish my term as a member of parliament. It's just a simple thing. And health, I always say, issues of health has got no political affiliation at all. TB, not only poor people that are affected by TB. It's only that the middle class and the rich are able to get expensive drugs, eat food, diet. They are in a home that is well ventilated. They are not staying in a shack. So it's quite a subject that we are to ensure that we keep it in our community's mind. But where does it start? The first unit of the community is the home. And if in our homes we don't then start, so that as we then go out, we hope that you will come, you will give us, there will be an information that we will need. And I'll be very much interested, really, on a serious note, the issue of the research in terms of what then our children are eating at school. Not only at school, maybe what they're eating at school is a reflection of what they're eating at home. Because at the end, that's where we are too. And therefore, your working together with the basic education is going to be very important in terms of the research. Thank you very much. The documents, honorable members, that we have been given, some of them, the secretary said that there are some provinces, members, at least we've got three members from one province. I'll make an example. I'm the only one from the Eastern Cape, so I've got mine from the Eastern Cape. So she has managed to give others. It just who will have an interest in which province. But if you do have some of the documents, so that we can then be able to give them, it will be very much it will be very much important. And yeah, okay. And then what we will then do, we will. But there are issues that you have raised in terms of the Department of Health, and there will be some challenges that we may have picked up of what is reflected on the Department of Health vis-a-vis what you are reflecting. And I do think that as we go on, I believe that it's people that are working that will always have some, make some mistakes here and there, or there are some misunderstandings. But we will look as the committee, when can we have a session with you without any pressure of time? A session that we are then going together with the Department of Health, have that round table, if I can put it, a round table debate about the issues of health. And you know that how passionate our minister is in terms of the non-communicable disease, burden of disease, and the number, and the diet, and the number of things. So thank you very much. We will then we'll communicate with you when we have discussed as a committee and agreeing. We'll circulate the date. I can't say when because I'll be in trouble because we have not discussed that. But I was just lifting it up as a matter that I think it is really going to be, it's really going to be very important. Because in sitting down, I do think that we have got a responsibility as this committee, irrespective of our political affiliation, we've got a responsibility of ensuring that every member of this house understands. But it's a fact that the African National Congress has always been lifting some of these things in the policy. If the challenge is the implementation part, then we'll have to deal with it. You are making it possible for us to be able to see the gap in terms of why are we not then being able to implement some of our policies that are very, very much important for the benefit of our people. And lastly is that we're talking about a sector that has got a history, a serious political history. And what the Department of Health, through the minister and ourselves, as people that are charged with the responsibility of looking into the legislation, is to address and change that history. It's not a secret. We want to leave a legacy that these are the issues that we have put in place so that we are able to. Honorable Ndaba raised a very important issue about mental health. Please, mental health, we know mental health has always have the stepchild. One MEC said that yesterday. It's a stepchild of the health sector. It must not be anymore. So I think what he has really raised and that you have acknowledged, please ensure that you do that. Circulate it to us even if we have not been calling you so that we are then able to learn and move forward and empower our people. Having said that, thank you very much. And thank you to our guests that have been here. And until we meet again, but I think we are going to meet again very soon. Thank you very much. I will request members to just have just 5 minutes stay whilst they are there so that we deal with the issues of the committee. Thank you. And thank you very much for this. Yeah. Mm-hmm.